from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to this Tuesday edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host for the day, Jody Heiss, sitting in for Tony, who is scheduled to be back in the chair tomorrow. But it's an honor to be sitting in his place this evening and glad to have you on board. We've got a lot to bring your way today. Let's begin with this story that will be coming here in just a few moments. Outrage continues to pour in over the decision by the International Criminal Court's top prosecutor to seek an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and others.
As the Prime Minister noted yesterday, this is a travesty of justice. It makes a mockery of international law. The charges presented by the ICC are a complete distortion of reality. Israel has taken unprecedented steps in the history of urban modern warfare to protect civilians in Gaza.
Well, that was Israeli government spokesperson Tal Heinrich earlier today. And we have right here in our own country, U.S. lawmakers on Capitol Hill are also up in arms. Even President Biden took a shot.
Whatever these warrants may imply, there is no equivalence between Israel and Hamas. And it's clear Israel wants to do all it can to ensure civilian protection. But let me be clear. Contrary to allegations against Israel made by the International Court of Justice, what's happening is not genocide. We reject that.
That took place yesterday at a Jewish Heritage Month event at the White House. And earlier this month, Texas Congressman Chip Roy introduced some legislation imposing sanctions on ICC officials. And he will be joining me here in just a few moments to discuss the need for such strong response as that, as the U.S. needs to be supporting Israel. And the ICC has never prosecuted democratically elected leaders of any Western democracy. So what in the world is the authority for which these unelected bureaucrats in The Hague are actually trying to possess? And perhaps a bigger question, what is the legal framework for any prosecution? Well, Professor Eugene Kontorovich, Director of the Center for Middle East and International Law at George Mason University Law School, will be joining me to explain this, and he will be joining us from Israel. And as we continue to address issues related to election integrity, there's a new study from Just Facts on the number of non-citizens who are registered to vote in the United States. And that number, friends, I'm telling you, it will shock you. I'll be talking about that with James Agresti with Just Facts a little bit later in the program. And ever since the Alabama Supreme Court recognized the personhood of embryos, you'll remember that, but ever since then, lawmakers in both parties have loudly been proclaiming their support for in vitro fertilization. Just this week, we had two Republican senators with strong pro-life backgrounds. They introduced legislation to federally protect access to IVF.
Unfortunately, we've seen a number of people try to fearmonger on this very issue. And so Ted and I came together, and we believe this effort should be bipartisan to make sure that every parent across the country who wants to bring life into this world and may be struggling with infertility or others but wants to use IVF to create the miracle of life, bring it into the world, has a certainty that that's going to be available to them.
Well, that was Senator Katie Britt of Alabama yesterday on Bloomberg TV, together with Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. So what's in this bill? And how, frankly, should Christians approach this sensitive topic from a biblical worldview? Family Research Council Director of the Center for Human Dignity will be joining me later in the program for that conversation. And just a reminder, before we jump into the specifics of today's program, last week the House of Representatives passed the Israel Security Assistance Support Act, which in essence rebukes President Biden for withholding weapons from Israel during this time of war against Hamas. But friends, listen, we all need to be involved in making our voices known, to call on the president to supply weapons so desperately needed right now to Israel. So we're asking you to join FRC in a petition that we've put together calling on the Biden administration to stop delaying these weapons shipments to Israel. We'd urge you to sign the petition. There's two ways you can do so. First of all, by going to frcaction.org/aid. That's frcaction.org/aid. Or you can simply text the word aid, A-I-D, to 67742 and sign on to that petition. All right, we've got a lot coming your way. And don't forget the website, of course, is tonyperkins.com. We have tons of resources available there for you. But let's jump into our first topic today, which involves the decision by the International Court, the prosecutor, the lead prosecutor, Karim Khan, and his efforts to pursue an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It is drawing fierce reaction from U.S. lawmakers. In fact, House Speaker Mike Johnson could potentially bring some legislation imposing sanctions on the ICC this week to the floor. So in addition to the ICC equating, and folks catch this, they literally are equating Israeli elected officials with Hamas terrorists. But perhaps a bigger question, at least for us to consider, is can the actions of this court teach us anything about the dangers of the U.S. ceding national sovereignty to an international organization? Well, joining me now to discuss this legislation is Congressman Chip Roy. He himself introduced legislation earlier this month that would impose sanctions against the ICC and its employees who investigate or prosecute the U.S. or its allies. Congressman Roy serves on the Judiciary Committee, also the Rules Committee, and the Budget Committee. He represents the 21st Congressional District of Texas. Congressman Roy, great to see you, my friend. Welcome back to Washington Watch.
Jody, great to be on. I'm up at the Rules Committee right now in a phone booth, so forgive me for my cramped quarters. I hope you can hear me okay.
Yeah, we hear you just fine. And listen, thank you. I know you've got so many plates spinning. Thank you for stepping out of the committee for just a few moments to spend with us. All right, let's start with this, Congressman. Your initial reaction to the ICC prosecutor's announcement for an arrest warrant.
Well, first of all, it was unfortunately not all that surprising, which is why we had set out several weeks ago, knowing this was potentially coming, to put a bill in place, do the hard work of making sure that it was structured the right way. We worked with Senator Tom Cotton, who in the Senate had introduced a sanctions bill. And then we worked and we produced a version that was similar, although we actually added some things that we thought strengthened it and made it work a little better. And we filed it on our side, and we now have 48 co-sponsors, maybe 50 now. Pretty significant cross-section of the conference, which you, as a fellow, you know, conservative and Freedom Caucus member, understand that it's important to have a pretty good cross-section. We've got everybody from, you know, Chip Roy and Andy Biggs to Brian Fitzpatrick, and you've got leadership folks like Elise Stefanik and others that are on this bill, because we all understand that this is a significant attack on our sovereignty. But importantly, a direct assault on Bibi Netanyahu and what he's doing to try to protect Israel from the obvious attacks that have been levied upon them. But more importantly, the attacks being levied upon them by the international community, the United Nations, obviously engaging in their resolution, which unfortunately the Biden administration, you know, sat down and didn't even participate. They abstained, which basically is a thumb in the eye to Israel. We've seen what's happening with Biden trying to take the funding away, or importantly, you know, not sending the munitions that were necessary. So we reacted last week. This is important that we send a united statement as Congress that this administration must stand aside Israel and not accept an illegitimate criminal court that interferes with their sovereignty or ours. Last point, President Trump in 2020 issued an executive order to basically say, we're going to sanction the ICC, the International Criminal Court, if they ever target Americans, target, you know, us or our allies. And unfortunately, Joe Biden, like many things, reversed that when he got into office. But this congressional act we put forward would require sanctions to be immediately applied on the ICC.
Okay, I want to underscore what perhaps our viewers and listeners did not catch. But you introduced this legislation earlier this month, long before the ICC made the announcement. Before all of this actually transpired, as it has in the last couple of days, you introduced this legislation. What did you see coming? Tell us why you introduced this weeks ago.
Well, if you go back, as I alluded to before, and you saw what the United Nations did in basically, you know, calling for a one-sided ceasefire, effectively siding with Hamas and undermining Israel, and the United States sitting on our hands and abstaining, well, that was a clear signal where the international community was going. And the ICC has been rattling and making indications that they were going to look at whatever was happening here in the context of, you know, war crimes and things that are completely out of bounds in terms of targeting the prime minister personally of Israel, but also just the leadership of Israel and the position Israel has rightly taken. I think it's important to note on a show like this with Family Research Council, where you have so many, obviously, people of faith, Christians, who hear these talking points that somehow there's indiscriminate killing of Palestinians. The data does not bear that out. Israel has bent over backwards, taking every step they can to try to not harm people that are civilians that are not, you know, directly tied to what is going on with Hamas. But Hamas is obviously intertwined with their communities. Israel has sent text messages. They've sent 15 million like leaflets. They've sent voicemails. They've given them 2 weeks notice. They've specifically made targeting areas so they can avoid civilian casualties. And their overall civilian casualty ratio is lower than the United Nations even suggests, and frankly, better than even America's been in past conflicts and many times. So that's a long-winded way to say we need to stand by Israel, defend their right to defend themselves. We can't let an entity like the International Criminal Court target Israel's sovereignty, because I promise you, they're going to come after ours. That's why these sanctions matter. It's why Trump was right, why Biden was wrong, and why Congress needs to act.
Absolutely. So let me ask you this last question. As you said, the ICC has really no authority over the United States or Israel, and yet they continue to push this type of control and authority, flexing their muscles. Does this illustrate, Congressman, why we should never relinquish national sovereignty to a bunch of international bureaucrats?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think we should have a wholesale review of all of our entanglements with international organizations. We send billions of dollars every year to the United Nations. It wasn't until just a couple of months ago that we finally got the defunding of UNRWA, right? The United Nations, I think what World Refugee Assistance, I think is what it stands for. And that was money funneling directly to Hamas. We know that. In fact, people funded by UNRWA were a part of attacking Israel on October 7th. So we should disentangle ourselves from the United Nations, defund them. The World Health Organization in the next 2 weeks is going to be issuing their guidelines or whatever the hell they're doing. This is essentially going to step all over our sovereignty. We should be acting on that. And then this International Criminal Court, what they're going to do to Israel, what they are trying to do to Israel, and specifically to Prime Minister Netanyahu, is what's going to come at us. We've got to disentangle ourselves, remind the world that we are sovereign, remind ourselves that we are sovereign, importantly, stand by our allies, have alliances that matter, not alliances that are just there for the sake of it, and these global alliances which undermine our sovereignty. And that's what we need to do. And this is an important step to do that. Every Republican should be a part of this. We need to sanction them and then go further when, Lord willing, President Trump is elected and we have the House.
Got to leave it right there. Congressman Chip Roy, thank you so much for stepping out of Rules Committee and for joining us on Washington Watch. Great, great information. All right, friends, more to come on the International Criminal Court's attack on Israel right after the break. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Lila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
You're tuned in to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Jody Heiss, sitting in today for Tony Perkins, and glad to have you joining us. All right, we want to continue to examine the fallout from yesterday's announcement that the prosecutor for the International Criminal Court is seeking an arrest warrant against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, in addition to three Hamas terrorists. But this marks the first time that the ICC has pursued such a tactic against a Western democracy. So what is the legal framework that allows these unelected bureaucrats to target democratically elected officials? And is the ICC more beholden to international power politics than they are the rule of law? Well, joining me now to discuss this is Eugene Kantorovich. He is the director of the Center for Middle East and International Law at George Mason University's Scalia Law School. Professor, welcome to Washington Watch. Glad to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on, Jay.
All right. Let's begin from a legal perspective. Okay. Explain to me what the International Criminal Court is and what kind of legal powers that it possesses.
So the International Criminal Court is not like a world court that hears cases and does justice for significant crimes around the world. It's an international organization that was created by a treaty a bit over 20 years ago, and it only has power over countries that have agreed to join it. Now, most countries that are likely to take place to participate in wars or hostilities have not joined the ICC. The United States has not joined the ICC. China has not joined the ICC. Most of the world's population live in countries that have not joined the ICC. Israel, like America, did not join the ICC because they were afraid of bias. So the ICC should have no authority over Israel whatsoever. But because they only have authority over countries that accept their jurisdiction. But the ICC invented a country called Palestine. It said there's a country called Palestine, which is not a member of the United Nations, is not recognized by the United States. And they let that fake country join the ICC. And then they also said that that country has all the territory that it claims. So now it's claiming that it's investigating Israeli crimes in the state of Palestine, namely Gaza. Of course, Israelis didn't vote for these judges. Israel has no authority over them. And the court has shown its systematic bias against the Jewish state in pretty much every action it has taken.
That's amazing. So So where is this going? I mean, the United States is not a member. Israel's not a member. They make up this Palestinian state. What authority do they have? And is there any degree of accountability against the ICC?
So the court, you know, can't really do anything directly against Israel. It's certainly not going to prosecute any Hamas leaders because they're not going to give themselves up. The real point of these charges is to be a kind of banner in a further diplomatic campaign to delegitimize Israel and to pressure and deter Israel from defending itself against the Hamas genocide. So now you're going to hear, when people talk about want to delegitimize Israel, they'll say, whose leaders were indicted of war crimes. And this has always been the case of blood libels against the Jews. It's not just about the particular individuals accused. It is more like a rallying. It's more like a rallying cry for, sorry about that. It's more like a rallying cry for the delegitimization of Israel. And I should say, this could not have happened without the green light from the Biden administration, because President Trump had imposed sanctions on the ICC. They said, we will sanction you if you go after American officials, which they had been trying to do. We will sanction you if you go after Israeli officials. And the bureaucrats at the ICC are not brave people. They want to tell every other country how to fight their wars, but they don't want to expose themselves to any risk. So they dropped their investigation of American officials when Trump put sanctions on them. President Biden lifted those sanctions. So now Congress is going to make a push to sanction ICC officials that are trying to undermine Israel's defense, and that is definitely something everybody should support.
Yep. What a tangled mess we've got here. We would not be in this mess, quite frankly, had the Biden administration not reversed those previous policies. So let me just get this straight from what you said a moment ago. The ICC, Prosecutor Karim Khan, this, in your opinion, is a politically driven motivation, not really a case of any kind of legal authority, but it is a politically driven situation. Is that an accurate assessment?
Absolutely. The court has no authority, and the crimes that it is alleging are preposterous. They're saying that Israel has starved Gazans to death. Of course, it's not clear that anyone has starved in Gaza. And to the extent there's a problem with food supplies there, it is well known that Hamas steals and plunders all the civilian, all the humanitarian supplies that are coming in. So it's not clear why it's Israel rather than Hamas that is being accused of this. It's clear that Egypt has been cutting supplies. So it's made up, quite frankly. But again, the point is not proving it in court, because this is almost certainly never going to get to court. It's about blackening Israel's name in the court of public opinion.
Let me hit this last question for you, and we've only got about a minute or so left. But you're in Israel now. So what is the reaction you're hearing from Israelis regarding the ICC?
Israelis of all political stripes across the board reject this as a biased prosecution that is basically designed to tie Israel's hands in a war of self-defense. Hamas does not mind being indicted by the ICC because they know that the only way they would ever get to The Hague is if they lose the war, in which case they'd much rather fall into the hands of The Hague than Israel. So all this can do is deter a democracy fighting a brutal Islamic terrorist state, an unprecedented, this has been rejected completely by Israelis. And Israelis know they have two choices. You know, we have two threats, Hamas and the ICC, and Hamas is a lot scarier. So Israel is not going to give up or relent in its fight against Hamas at all, because, you know, the ICC may cause diplomatic problems, but Hamas is out to kill every last Jewish person here.
Thank you so much, Professor Eugene Kantorovich from George Mason University. Very grateful for you joining us on the program. All right, friends, coming up, there's a new study with some disturbing findings about non-citizens voting in our elections. The numbers are going to be shocking. It's coming your way right after the break, so stay tuned.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Lila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold, or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Jody Heiss sitting in today for Tony. I'm glad to have you with us as well. All right, Election Day, it's less than 6 months away, and we have a recent study from Just Facts, the organization called Just Facts, and they are sharing some extremely disturbing findings. 10 to 27% of non-citizens are illegally registered to vote. That's shocking. Now, keep in mind, the U.S. Census recorded a population of nearly 20 million voting-age non-citizens in the U.S. during 2022. So it certainly has surpassed 20 million by now. So the extent of the problem is just staggering. Here to share more about this shocking study is Jim Agresti. He's the president and co-founder of Just Facts. Jim, welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Jody, thank you for having me on.
Well, it's our honor. Let's just jump into this. How in the world are these ineligible voters able to vote in the first place?
Well, there are very broad openings for non-citizens to vote. In no state in the nation are they required to provide proof of U.S. citizenship in order to register to vote. Now, a couple of states like Arizona tried to enact that requirement, but they were blocked by a court ruling supported by the Obama administration. And if you look at the federal voter registration form, it says you can submit all different forms of ID to register. That could be a social security number, it could be a driver's license number, or it could just be a utility bill. I mean, these are things that anyone can get by living here. They do not prove you're a U.S. citizenship. You're a U.S. citizen. And more than that, a lot of non-citizens have fake social security numbers, especially illegal immigrants. That's what they do to work. At a recent estimate by the Social Security Administration, they tallied 2.5 million non-citizens who had social security numbers gained by using fake birth certificates or stealing those numbers from somebody else.
Wow. 2 million. All right. Well, look, the breakdown is beyond description. Any idea where the breakdown is? And I want to go on to other questions, but is this an intentional breakdown in the process, or is it just absolute incompetence? What's going on?
Well, it's always hard to read people's minds, but I could tell you this. The vast bulk of these non-citizens are voting for Democrats. According to the best data we have, About 80% of them will vote for Democrats when they vote illegally. And Democrats are fighting tooth and nail to prevent any kind of checking of people's citizenship. It does benefit them. Is that their reasoning? It's an obvious incentive, but I can't read their minds.
Wow. Well, all of this is of extreme interest to the entire country. In fact, I just published a book last month, Sacred Trust, Election Integrity and the Will of the People. Every time one of these illegal individuals votes, it takes away a legal vote of a U.S. citizen. So how extensive is this problem in your estimation, your studies?
So based on the latest available data, approximately 1 million to 2.7 million non-citizens are going to vote in the upcoming presidential election unless something changes. And that is more than enough to tip the results of congressional races, Senate races, and yes, the U.S. presidency.
So what do we do about it? I mean, here it comes down to an enormous problem. We're talking in excess of 1, 2, 3 million people, who knows how many it may be, who you say are going to vote illegally. What at this point, with the election 6 months away, what can we do about it?
Well, the Republicans have introduced a bill to require proof of citizenship in order to register to vote. Will that be the bill be enacted before the next election? Obviously not. So I don't think there's anything that plausibly can be done at this moment. However, I do think in the aftermath of the election, and we hate to have a repeat of 2020, that there should be some accountability, some lawsuits that demand proof that people are who they say they are in tight races. None of that was secured in the last round of election lawsuits, and it needs to be there. A candidate has to make a plea and say, hey, I want this data to prove that these people who are registered and voted actually are citizens.
And this is not a difficult lift. I mean, we know the borders are wide open. We know these folks, I mean, more and more studies are coming out indicating that they are being encouraged to register to vote by different organizations and so forth. We know there's a problem. It's not a heavy lift to find out whether or not these individuals are citizens or not. So any idea what the status is of the bill that you mentioned, the legislation that could be potentially moving?
My guess is it will move in the House and die in the Senate, but that's just an educated guess. And again, even if somehow it got through the Senate, there's no way Joe Biden signing that bill.
No, I'm afraid you're right. Jim Agresti with Just Facts, president and co-founder, thank you so much for the research you've done. Thank you for taking time to join us today on Washington Watch. Greatly appreciate it.
Jody, thank you for having me, and I'm sorry I couldn't give you better news.
Well, hey, listen, we can't fix the problems if we don't know what we're dealing with. So thank you so much. All right, friends, coming up, FRC's Mary Zonk is going to be joining me as we consider IVF, in vitro fertilization, the entire industry. We're going to be looking at it in light of legislation that was introduced by two Republican senators, and looking at it from a biblical worldview perspective. So much more is coming your way here on Washington Watch. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after this break.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Jody Heiss, sitting in today for Tony, and glad to have you on board with us. And just a reminder, with the World Health Assembly beginning later this month, friends, time is running out to tell Washington not to let the Biden administration cede authority, our U.S. authority, our sovereignty, to the World Health Organization. For information how you can help do that, how you can make your voice known, I encourage you to visit one of two options. You can go to frcaction.org/who, or you can simply text the word WHO to 67742. Friends, this is a major issue, and we encourage you to make your voice known. We don't want to yield our sovereignty to the World Health Organization. All right, let's move on here. An Alabama Supreme Court decision recognizing the dignity of human embryos set off a firestorm earlier this year. Some of you, I'm sure, will remember that. But leaders from both parties started promoting their support for in vitro fertilization. Well, yesterday, Republican Senators Ted Cruz and Katie Britt announced that they are introducing legislation that they say will federally protect legal access to IVF.
It's a very simple bill that says if a state receives Medicaid funding that they cannot bar IVF, that a state can and a local government can't, that it is a federal right, that you are entitled to have access to this technology and a state cannot bar it.
Of course, that was Senator Cruz, and that was yesterday on Megyn Kelly's program, together there with Senator Britt. Look, I have no doubt that the senators were well-intentioned in this bill, but was it a rushed move on a very complicated issue? And how should Christians consider the entire IVF industry? Well, joining me now to discuss this is Mary Zock. She's the director of the Center for Human Dignity here at the Family Research Council. Mary, welcome back to the program. Always great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, let's start by, if you can, let's begin just explaining what would this legislation do if it's passed? What would be the result?
Well, as Senator Cruz said, this legislation ties Medicaid funding to a state's laws regarding IVF and says that if a state prohibits IVF, they won't receive Medicaid funding.
So that sounds like a big deal. I mean, to tie this whole thing to Medicaid funding in itself sounds pretty strong on the one hand, but it seems to me that there are a lot of other issues to consider in all of this. We all know, in fact, I believe we had you on when the Alabama Supreme Court decision came out that, in essence, recognized human embryos as human beings, and that created hysteria that was fueled. Is this a response to the Alabama decision?
This absolutely is a response to that decision, and it is a huge deal. The Medicaid funding that a state receives is significant, and states are not going to opt out of receiving Medicaid funding. And we know that Democrats could take this same concept and turn it on its head and say, you know what, we're going to tie state Medicaid funding to whether or not a state protects unborn children in the womb. If a state does not allow a woman to have an abortion, well, we're going to take away their Medicaid funding. And all of this is in response to that Alabama Supreme Court decision that said embryos must be treated as persons. That Supreme Court decision did not say, it did not attack IVF. What it did was it said that the IVF industry has to treat the embryo as a human being, which it is. Scientifically, it is. And so to assign a different set of value to an embryo simply because it's not conceived within a woman's body, it's morally, logically, and scientifically inconsistent.
Yeah, there's so many issues with this. Do you have any idea, let me start with this, any idea at all why they chose to tie Medicaid to this bill?
Well, I think it is to make this a federal right. This is something that, as I mentioned, states are not going to opt out of. And so this is really a huge stick that they're using to force states into not prohibiting IVF in any way. Now, a key point here is that no states are currently trying to prohibit IVF. But what this bill does not do is it doesn't say what a quote-unquote prohibition on IVF would be. Does that include saying that, you know, a state doesn't actually want to endorse intentional motherlessness or intentional fatherlessness, and so IVF can only happen between married heterosexual couples? Does that mean that a state decides, you know what, we don't actually want to endorse human trafficking, and we know that that's linked to surrogacy, so we're going to say that surrogacy, paid surrogacy, is prohibited within our state? Does that mean that a state can't say an embryo has human DNA, it is a person, and so that those embryos must be treated with dignity and respect, and that means they can't be frozen, they can't be destroyed? Are those, in fact, what would be considered prohibitions under this bill? We know that the Democrats would think so.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's really what brought about the entire Alabama Supreme Court decision, was some of the embryos were destroyed, and Alabama came back and said, well, those were human beings, which is good. I mean, we recognize that life, human life, begins at conception, but we have millions of these embryos already frozen. So, I mean, there's a lot. What is ever going to happen to those embryos? It's this whole industry is like the wild, wild west in many ways. It is so unregulated. We don't really know what's happening to these embryos and what kind of protections there are. And if I'm correct, none of those issues, like you just suggested, are dealt with in this legislation. Is that correct?
That is correct. They're not. What this legislation does is it protects the IVF industry. And that's what the Alabama Supreme Court tried to do, was to say, hey, we're going to focus on the parents and on the children who are conceived through the IVF industry. The backlash was created by the IVF industry itself. This is not a bill that protects parents. It doesn't say, you know, actually, if an IVF doctor uses his own sperm to fertilize an egg, that he can be penalized. It doesn't say, you know, if an IVF clinic doesn't store embryos in a safe, secure place, if they don't put as many protections on them as CVS uses on their razor blades, well, they can actually be penalized for that because those are human beings, and parents have invested so much into those children's lives. It doesn't do any of that. It just protects the IVF industry. And that's where we need to make a change. We need to say IVF needs to be regulated in the United States. It can't operate as it does, where anything goes.
Excellent point. Well, earlier today, there were some Senate Democrats that held a press conference on the catastrophic effect, they said, of pro-life laws. And Senator Patty Murray was asked specifically about this Cruz-Britt bill. And I wanted to play her response here and get a little reaction from you.
If Republicans really wanted to make sure that IVF was available, they would support our effort to make sure that IVF is in every state. I am confident that our legislation will do that. We are not going to accept any legislation that puts in law personhood.
Okay, now she was speaking specifically of the Duckworth bill. So can you tell us a little bit about what their bill would do?
Well, the Duckworth bill would allow the Wild West of reproductive rights to become even more wild. You know, we're talking about legalizing chimeras, legalizing cloning, things that Americans believe as unconscionable. What they're really trying to get at here, though, is that infertility is an incredibly painful cross. And it is such a struggle for couples who are carrying it. And it's one that I, as the mother of two with two in heaven, I can't imagine what that cross would be like to carry. But I know that the solution is not a completely unregulated industry that exploits the good desires of parents to become mothers and fathers. There are actually solutions that are more effective. IVF is not actually highly successful. It doesn't treat the underlying cause of infertility. These are things that we need to do. The Duckworth bill and the Cruz bill, neither of those does that.
Okay, so let's step into the next pathway, I guess, of this whole argument. As Christians, how should we think about IVF? With consistent biblical and reasonable logic, what is a Christian response to this entire industry?
Well, I think the first thing that we need to do is acknowledge that couples who are struggling with infertility are on an incredibly difficult journey. And we need to support them, and we need to help them carry that cross. And whether that means just asking someone, hey, do you want to talk about this? Or being extra supportive around difficult times for people. Those are steps that we as Christians need to take. Secondly, we need to recognize that the desire to have children is a godly desire, and that is good. But we cannot allow that desire to become out of order from where it should be. We can't allow that desire to completely dominate and separate us from doing things that we know are aligned with God's will. And that begins with respecting the dignity of every human person, the mother, the father, and any future children who may be conceived. And so with that comes recognizing that the IVF industry preys upon women. There are all sorts of medical challenges that women face as the result of IVF, whether it's an increased risk of ectopic pregnancy or of preeclampsia or of multiple births, which brings with it a more challenging pregnancy. But those physical challenges brought on by IVF, don't even speak to the emotional and mental toll that the process takes. And that is a burden that's carried by both the mother and the father. Pornography is an integral part of the IVF process. And the husband's use of pornography is typically how sperm is obtained. That's not good for a marriage. We know that pornography goes against what God tells us about the dignity of men and women and the marital act. And then we know that embryos, while some of them do result in a baby that is one day held by the mother and father, we know that an embryo is a human being from the moment that embryo is conceived and the moment that egg is fertilized. And so that embryo must be treated with dignity and respect. Only 7% of all embryos ever created result in a baby that is held in a mother's arms. And so that means 93% are either destroyed, discarded, frozen, experimented on, or placed in a freezer for future use. And that is something that we really have to reckon with. And then in addition to that, we know that IVF has been used to enable gay parenting, which we know is not good for children. We know that it has been used with surrogacy, which we know can be linked to human trafficking and again, separates a child from his mother. So I think as Christians, we are tasked with looking at the complete picture. And yes, infertility is a huge cross and we need to help couples with that. And we can point them towards options like restorative reproductive medicine that actually can address infertility and that actually has significantly higher success rates than IVF does.
Well, those are incredible points there, all of which need understanding. I think a lot of our challenge in all of this is educating people about the IVF industry and really what is involved, both from the parents' perspective as well as the embryos themselves. There are so many issues. And, you know, I guess how should, final question, how should pro-life politicians address the whole life issue when you have Democrats like Chuck Schumer making claims like this? I want to play this last clip and get your response to this.
The far right has shown that they actually want to force their will on the entirety of this country. We all know they won't stop until they've enacted a federal abortion ban. They will not stop, America, until they get a federal abortion ban.
Just less than a minute, but your reaction to that.
I would challenge every American to recognize that what he's talking about, a federal abortion ban, would mean a national protection for an unborn child. That's what he's opposed to. That's not legislation that's on the table right now, but that is what the Democrat Party is opposed to, is protecting unborn children in the womb. That's something we should all be striving for.
Well, Mary, I can't thank you enough for coming on and unpacking this for us. It's an extremely complicated issue, and this piece of legislation likewise is very complicated. Thank you so much for taking time with us. We appreciate it.
So much for having me.
All right, friends, that wraps up another edition of Washington Watch. Thank you so much for joining us. Tony should be back in the chair tomorrow. I hope you have a great remainder of your evening, and thank you for joining us on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.